Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance or don't understand the differences between insurance plans or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein, and this is Spy Talk. Jason Leopold, a senior reporter with Bloomberg News, has literally been getting under the skin of government bureaucracies for decades. His weapon, the Freedom of Information Act, enacted by Congress in the mid-1960s because the feds, well, they had an insidious propensity for burying embarrassing or even illegal acts under layers of official secrecy. Over the years, the law has been strengthened, but that's not stopped the government from continuing its bad behavior. And that's where Leopold, a multiple prize-winning, much-admired, relentless digger comes in. The 55-year-old journalist is a legend for forcing the government to release explosive documents ranging from Hillary Clinton's secret email server to CIA torture procedures to Donald Trump's misrouting, should we say, of highly classified documents from the White House to Mar-a-Lago. For his efforts, the FBI labeled Jason an FOIA terrorist, a moniker he cheerfully welcomes. May 1st, meanwhile, the day of our interview, marked the 7th anniversary of his most favorite FOIA triumph, the release of details on a threatening telephone call, a person imitating a mafia thug, all but certainly Trump, made to a lawyer representing investors going after him after the failure of his Atlantic City casino. It seemed like a good day to ring Jason up. Jason Leopold, welcome to Spy Talk. Good to see you, my friend. Now, why do you do this? What in life motivated you to sit at a keyboard day after day pestering the government? Did you have some childhood trauma about family secrets being kept from you? Was it your early stint as an obituary writer digging up family secrets? Why do you want to pester the government every day?
Well, first of all, Jeff, I love the battle. I love the fight. And I love knowing that there is something secret that is being kept from the public and that I have the ability to possibly pry that loose. As far as family trauma or secrets, sure, there may be some of that exists there. But really, I totally enjoyed the battle.
But you didn't follow the route of investigative reporting per se in the normal sense of the word. You became a document specialist, digging up documents that the government doesn't want you to see. Why did you take that route?
Well, it's kind of perfect for the conversation we're having on your show. I had covered national security for a very long time. After 9/11, when everything was deemed to be either a national security threat or classified at some level, it became very, very difficult to glean information from people, from sources about a wide range of topics. And then when you would try to get some information, it would be attributed to anonymous sources. And so that always made me feel uncomfortable. And one of the reasons it made me feel uncomfortable is because I didn't know if it was, you know, if it was true. I'm not seeing any kind of paper to back it up. And so, you know, during the course of that kind of reporting, the stories would evolve or they would shift. And so I always felt that it was not entirely 100%. So I had filed Freedom of Information Act requests at that point, but not at the level that I certainly do now. So when I discovered that I could not only file Freedom of Information Act requests with the CIA, with the NSA, with DOD, with every intel agency and other agencies within the executive branch, but that I could also sue to pry loose those records, that's when I felt that this was going to be an incredibly powerful tool that I could use in such a way that would set me apart from reporters at the New York Times, excellent reporters like yourself, and other national security reporters. Because as you know, Jeff, this was a very, very, very competitive beat, you know, in the post 9/11 world.
Many listeners may not realize that this whole thing, this Freedom of Information Act, was a radical, radical change in giving citizens access to government secrets. It was propounded in a very sort of brief, bright, shining period of reform in American life as a result of scandals, Nixon administration stuff, CIA assassinations, and coup d'etats and so on. And so during this brief period of sunlight, this act was passed by Congress, and it gave an incredible, put an incredible tool into the hands of not just reporters, but citizens who can file Freedom of Information Act requests about themselves. Now, going on to your particular work, you're kind of a nonpartisan equal opportunity assassin, aren't you? I mean, I'm sure you're taking note of that.
Yes.
I mean, most people think that this is sort of a liberal tool. You know, this is a lib way of taking down Republicans. But in fact, I mean, I'm sure you got a ton of crap from liberals for unearthing Hillary Clinton's private emails.
Yes.
And more recently, the fact that Obama took home, as you wrote, a heartfelt letter sent to Obama in 2009 by Natomi Canfield, a woman who had battled breast cancer, struggled to pay her health insurance premiums, and became the face of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. White House staffers framed this nice letter from her to the president, along with a pen that Obama had used to sign his signature piece of healthcare legislation. And he took this framed picture home.
When he was supposed to return
it. Such an innocent act. But you come along and dig up a record, get it from the government, says he shouldn't have taken that home. Now, this is hardly on par with what Trump did with documents in Mar-a-Lago, but still, why are you so mean?
Well, let me tell you the backstory. One, you're right. I hold myself out as being that kind of, I like the way you put it. What was it? Nonpartisan assassin? Is that how you put it?
Equal opportunity assassin.
Yes, that's exactly what I am. And with the Hillary Clinton email, so to be clear, so your listeners understand, you know, I filed the FOIA request that became the vehicle by which all of Hillary Clinton's emails were released. Now, when I did that, I didn't know that she had a private server. My motivation for doing that was to, one, we knew that she was going to be the Democratic nominee for president. And I wanted the public to see how she performed as the nation's top diplomat on issue and handled issues such as foreign policy, LGBTQ issues, human rights. So I felt that getting her emails would provide the public with some insight behind the scenes into, you know, what was transpiring within her you know, during her tenure as Secretary of State.
So what you're saying is that getting a word of her private email server and those emails was kind of an accident. You had no idea. You were after something much larger, her performance
exactly.
as Secretary of State. You didn't know she had a private email server and traffic.
I had no clue. And in fact, when I filed the lawsuit, it was 2 months later when the New York Times broke the story that she had a private email server. Now, as somebody who really believes in the power of the Freedom of Information Act, I was incensed because that meant that, one, that her emails weren't being preserved under the Federal Records Act. At least that was my initial instinct. And two, why was this happening? So we continued to pursue my case, and the release of the emails was ordered in my case by a judge every month. The State Department fought it. But, you know, what unfortunately happened is that the scandal revolving around the server became obscured all the information that we could learn from, you know, what were in those, you know, what was in those emails.
Well, that begs the question I have to ask you. Did it obscure more important information in your mind that gave us a better sense of her foibles as Secretary of State?
Yeah, you know, look, I mean, I want to be clear. I wasn't looking for a smoking gun in the sense of like, aha, we found this. What I wanted to see is how she was handling issues such as, you know, the Afghanistan war. The surge, if you recall that back in, mm-hmm. I think it was 2009, how she was responding to that, how mm-hmm. she was handling the repatriation of detainees at Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. And did anything? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There were lots of great emails that showed her, that contained her discussions with, you know, some of the diplomats that she had been communicating with over these issues. There was some of her former campaign advisors that were, you know, telling her that she was too soft on, you know, Afghanistan and that she had to dial it up a bit. So I felt like that, and also human rights issues, but I felt, you know, she had a very, you know, very strong position, you know, wanting to ensure that certain countries were adhering to the Convention Against Torture. So it was really insightful just to see how she was dealing
yeah.
with it.
But all of which pales in comparison to the discovery
right.
that she was operating a private email server.
Yeah. But it did become, you know, what, moving that all aside, like that case obviously became the biggest case that I had.
Obviously,
as
it remains a bugaboo.
Yes.
The Republicans are still using it as a weapon against her.
Right.
Now, I want to move on because today I saw on Twitter/X, he said 7 years ago today, and this illustrates that you are an equal opportunity assassin. 7 years ago today, you wrote, perhaps my favorite FOIA story about Donald Trump's casino business after it went bankrupt in 2009, and you uncovered some gangster-like behavior. Tell us about that.
This was pretty amazing. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI, and I then sued the FBI, and I asked them for all records that they had related to any investigations into Donald Trump and Trump's businesses prior to any announcement that he was going to run for president. So kind of predating, you know, that time frame. The FBI eventually responded with a bunch of records that were heavily redacted. And what was very interesting about one of the records that I received from the FBI is that this was almost totally redacted, except, you know, it had the type of case, you know, that it was, and it referred to the potential crime that was associated with it. And the, you know, the crime was not coercion, but it rose to the level of making threats, you know, like terrorist type threats. And this person represented investors in Trump's casino business, right? Casino business that was going bankrupt. So he represented the investors, and he was on his way. He was a lawyer on his way to court. He gets a phone call, and that phone call, he says, you know, he received a threat that if you fuck with Trump, we're going to come after you and your family. He reports this threat to the FBI, and he reports it to a police station. Now, I didn't know any of this because the FBI redacted it. However, the FBI left a clue in the document. And so they redacted this under a privacy exemption, Jeff. Mm-hmm. For the FOIA followers, that's the B6 exemption. They redacted this under a privacy exemption, but they left a clue. And that clue was a zip code. I was able to trace that zip code to a law firm in downtown New York. And I saw that there was a lawyer there who happened to represent Trump entertainment investors. And that lawyer, I found, lived in a suburb of New Jersey. And on a whim, since the FBI redacted the contents of the threat, I knew that he filed a report with the police department. So I, you know, requested the records from the police department. Turns out that the threat came from a payphone outside the Ed Sullivan Theater, where David Letterman was being filmed at the time, and where Donald Trump was appearing that evening.
So to recap,
yes,
this long story. This guy who, let's make a jump here and say we think it was Trump, in a heavy, thick New York accent, calls the lawyer for investors in Trump's failed casino, who's representing people who want to get their money back or get their losses covered in some way. This guy, who we think logically was Trump, imitates kind of a thug. Calls himself, what, Gino or something?
Carmine.
Even better. That's right out of the Sopranos.
Yeah.
He calls himself Carmine, and he says, lay off. We're going to fuck with you so bad if you keep pestering Trump.
Right.
Yep. I mean, you can't make it up, as they say.
No, it was unbelievable. And kind of my favorite part about this story was, one, you know, how it sleuthed out the information. But then after I was able to kind of reveal what the actual threat was, a few months later, the FBI responds and they said, oh, you know what? We decided to unredact it. So here you go. So that was a fun one. That was back in 2017.
We have to step away for a moment for a message from our sponsors. Okay, we're back now. And sticking with Trump, that was a very good one. Sticking with Trump, for Bloomberg, you did a FOIA request and got documents saying that Trump had packed top secret Mar-a-Lago documents down in, you know, these top secret documents and so on. Tell us about that.
Sure. So, you know, just to kind of give you some understanding of what makes me kind of tick in a sense and file these requests is that whenever there is something coming out publicly, if I'm not getting that information about what to request from sources or from reading some you know, report, there will be something in the news. And in this case, it was Donald Trump, as we already knew, that the FBI went to Mar-a-Lago to retrieve those classified records. He had blamed the General Service Administration, the GSA. Mm-hmm.
That they had mishandled these documents.
That they had mishandled the documents, that they packed everything. It was their fault. Mm-hmm. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the GSA. And I said, I'd like to have all the emails and photographs that you have related to the moving of any, you know, of any boxes after Trump left the White House. And just by way of background, that's what the GSA does. So they kind of handle work with transition teams, presidential transition teams. They, you know, they assist administration when it's leaving to kind of move that property into GSA
facilities. But you sensed from Trump's history, you know, he was lying about that. He was shifting blame to somebody else.
Yeah, I sensed that something was
so
definitely...
on a hunch, you might say. You say, well, let's see what the facts are here.
Let's see what the documents say.
And they said?
I got documents very quickly, and it not only it had these extraordinary pictures of these pallets, you know, with green cellophane wrapped all over it. And it showed that, one, that the GSA handled it in a way that was, you know, that was Trump was in the know. Trump's camp was in the know on everything, you know, that they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it also did not have, there were not classified documents that they were packing. So that's one thing that was very clear, is that there were not classified documents that, you know, that they also mailed it, sent it to a warehouse in Florida. So it really kind of, one, undercut the narrative that Trump mm-hmm. and his supporters tried to put out there about how this happened.
So Trump and his people, they were orchestrating, quarterbacking the entire
right.
document.
Right.
Now, this leads me to another quick question. I don't want to get mired in the bureaucracy of FOIA requests, but just
sure.
briefly, you got this, you got these documents on the Mar-a-Lago shenanigans virtually overnight. Other requests can take years and years and still be very unsatisfactory. So why is it that you got these? So is it just because you just hit the right judge or magistrate at the right time with this
no.
request? Or?
No, the reason I got these documents very quickly, I didn't sue for these. I just simply filed a request. But I
right.
also asked for expedited processing. And I mm-hmm. made a case of why there was an overwhelming public interest and that these records are needed on an urgent, expedited basis. And as a result, the agency agreed and handed them over within about a month.
Hmm. Well, you could ask for expedited processing on everything you file, couldn't you? It wouldn't matter in other cases.
You could, but the agency has, you have to state your case. You have to, you know, make it a convincing argument that there's a breaking news, you know, and that the public needs to know about this. And so that's the argument I made. And it was, I went into some detail as to, it's almost like the way you pitch a story that I need to work on this project for this long because, you know, it's important why.
Yeah. And in this case, it was because Trump was a presumptive Republican nominee and citizens needed
exactly.
to know about this. Let me ask you about another one. How
sure.
fast you got it. Another big victory on your part was you got the CIA's internal justification for killing a U.S. citizen in Yemen, namely Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was
right.
killed in a drone strike, was I think. And you got internal CIA deliberations on this. Did they respond overnight? What kind of struggle did you go through to get those documents?
So that was a Justice Department white paper that had the legal authorization. And that was a battle, Jeff. I mean, that was a years-long battle. I think it was maybe 2-3 year battle.
And how did
to
they
get
justify dragging their feet on that?
Well, one, they justify it by simply saying that there's, you know, this is a national security risk, and that it would threaten national security in multiple different ways.
Which is bullshit, because we're just talking about legal arguments here.
Correct. And, you know, and then on top of it, they did say that in addition to that, because they were legal arguments, right? That they, you know, that this is attorney-client privilege, work product, exactly. So they tried to hide behind that. So, you know, the case wound its way through the court for months and months with each side exchanging motions. But the way in which we were able to get this released is that there was a prior, you know, disclosure of some material. You know, that ultimately led to the release of this extraordinary document, because I'm sure you remember at the time, right? That was a very, very controversial move from the Obama administration, taking out Awlaki in a drone strike.
And it remains very sensitive.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about another one. And I could see why they would really drag their feet on this one. You managed to pry loose security procedures, documents relating to security procedures at Guantanamo. How did you get those?
Yeah, that was great. So this is was a different move that I made. So there was a case already in U.S. District Court, and these were the habeas cases that were taking place over the detention of people captured in Afghanistan and elsewhere, and then shipped over to Guantanamo. So they were challenging their indefinite detention. And some of the arguments that came up from these detainees was, you know, related to their, you know, to their treatment. And through one of these cases, I asked for the, you know, kind of the standard operating procedures, you know, over at Guantanamo. So I intervened as a reporter in that case. It's still, you know, it's still kind of like, consider it like the sister of FOIA, you know, the you know, public right of access to, you know, to certain records. But I did it through intervening in an existing court case. And the, you know, the folks at Guantanamo said that Al-Qaeda would attack Guantanamo if these records got out. Hmm. And frankly, the judge just didn't buy that, Jeff. I'm not sure where they would come from to get to Guantanamo.
They really argued that Al-Qaeda would invade this heavily probably one of the most heavily fortified U.S. base in the world at Guantanamo, of all places, and to liberate the prisoners in there. They would somehow wash ashore in Cuba and take over Guantanamo. And they really made this with a straight face. They made
they
this
did.
Argument.
And, you know, then they went, added a couple of other items to it, you know, which were the fact that, you know, if this got out, it would embolden our enemies. They would, you know, that may lead to other terrorist attacks. So that was a line they always hid behind. I mean, thankfully, there was a judge who just didn't buy it. And since it did, you know, I'm happy to say, Jeff, since this document was released, Al-Qaeda has not attacked Guantanamo.
No. Thank God. moving on to another one, the Mueller investigation. You're everywhere. Your footprints are – you have footprints through some of the most extraordinary release of documents in the last 20-plus years.
Yeah.
Another one was the Mueller investigation. You got them to unredact portions of the Mueller report that revealed that Don Jr. – had come under the gaze of the Mueller investigators.
Yeah, well, he came under the suspicion and of the investigators on Mueller's team because he had been communicating with WikiLeaks, and they were considering charging him with a misdemeanor computer intrusion crime for essentially accessing an anti-Trump website, but using a password that he obtained from WikiLeaks. What's noteworthy, what's really noteworthy, Jeff, is that the Mueller report, the 400-page plus report, his name was redacted, right? Because Don Jr. was never charged. And what I had moved to do during the course of this FOIA case was to unredact multiple passages that were blacked out in the Mueller report. And we ultimately won, and we were able to get Don Jr.'s name unredacted. So if you look at a version of the Mueller report now on the Justice Department website, you'll see that, and you'll see that Mueller was considering, you know, charging him, but he declined to do so, citing insufficient evidence. You know, we also did the same with Roger Stone. You know, we were able to get material, you know, unredacted there, you know, to show that he too was, you know, there was going to be additional charges related to hacking.
Are you still pursuing the Mueller, some of the Mueller material? Are there things in there that still need uncovering?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, part of it is I really did ask for everything, you know, and then we sued for it. So there is a universe of records that I continue, you know, to receive. And some of those records continue to be, you know, FBI 302 reports. And as you know, as the case moves forward as the investigation has kind of wound down and there's no longer any reason to withhold certain material under an ongoing investigation exemption within the FOIA.
So what are some of the things you're after now?
Well, it's some of the things relate to more about, you know, Paul Manafort, more information about, you know, Don Jr., Roger Stone. But a lot of it really is just, it's not even so much what I'm after. It's just that the government can only, you know, provide us with about 500 pages per month, you know. So they're just continuing to go, you know, continuously make their productions. But I will say some of the things that continue to come out are related to the decision to the Justice Department's decision to reduce the charges against Michael Flynn and the time, if you remember that whole blow up with Barr. So some of the records coming out of that decision and what was taking place behind the scenes, which you know, perhaps will be a story down the road that I'll. You know, that I'll have on that. But there's a lot of records.
Since Flynn is still, and Barr is still so much in the news for their very strange conversations and activities these days,
yeah.
What do you suspect is yet to be found about Flynn and Barr?
That's a good question. You know, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. And I think the reason I say that is because every time I read a document or hear something, it's just, sometimes it's just bonkers and it's not anything that I would have expected. So I'm not sure what to expect, you know, and that's part of the fun too, of certainly getting records from that particular investigation. Cause it's, I just have no clue what's in there. And then when I do see it, it's like, whoa, you know.
Well, you're pursuing the diamond cause you suspect some skullduggery. And under the table stuff that went on in regard to those prosecutions. I want to move along finally to, and I don't mean this is one of your final cases. We together decided let's look at these 5-6 cases.
Sure.
Of sort of, you know, your greatest hits, you might say. You uncovered documents related to the CIA's torture program. Tell us about those.
Oh yeah, that is a number of documents related to, you know, the treatment of detainees at CIA black sites who were held there, the contracts that the CIA entered into with the two psychologists, the amount of money that was spent.
Millions
of dollars. This case is still ongoing. What was really noteworthy are a number of the IG reports that were classified, highly classified. The IG reports into the deaths of detainees. And then, you know, when the Senate Intelligence Committee was investigating it and the allegations that the CIA was then spying on the staffers who were investigating it, and there was an investigation, another investigation into the investigation. I pried loose the records there. What was really amazing within those records is I ended up getting a letter that was addressed to Dianne Feinstein written by John Brennan. And
CIA director
at the time, and the letter was never signed. I got a call one day from the CIA public affairs office and said that they released that to me accidentally.
Too bad.
Yeah, too bad.
That happens all the time, though.
Oh,
I
wish it happened all the time, but that helped. You know, this was at a time, Jeff, where I had 300 pages of these documents that were, you know, declassified for me and released, and I was trying to figure out, God, what's the lead of my story? What should it be? And then I got that phone call, and after I hung up the phone, I said, I got it. Now I got the lead. So the records really peeled back the curtain to provide the public with incredible insight into what was taking place at the black sites. We knew that from some of your reporting, from the reporting from, you know, some of your former colleagues at the Washington Post, Dana Priest, who did extraordinary work. But now I have the documents, and now I have the documents that showed in extraordinary detail, you know, what was really happening what those investigations looked like, how those investigations ultimately, you know, were did not lead to any accountability, why they didn't lead to any accountability. It became an important part of history. And I feel like that is ultimately what's very important about the work that I do, why I take it so seriously, the FOIA work, is because it's a part of history, right? As you mentioned, the Mueller investigation, those documents are not just so I can, you know, get some great stories out of it. It's so the public can have something to look back on, you know, that doesn't, it's not just Robert Mueller's narrative. It's the raw intel, you know, that went along with it.
I'm sure that there, for every person who celebrates government transparency and your unremitting drive to uncover these important pieces of information the public should know, there are people who feel very threatened. Some very not nice people feel very threatened by you. I have to ask you, do you get threats to back off?
I never get threats. To be honest with you, I never get threats to back off.
That's good.
I mean, basically, the only thing that takes, you know, that happens is they will, you know, delay the release of records or stonewall or try to come up with various reasons why, you know, certain records should not be released. And I think that their dependence on, you know, their rationale, their dependence on certain parts of the law are wrong. But no threats, no threats.
You haven't gotten a call from Carmine.
I have not gotten a call from Carmine. No, no. I mean, during that time of reporting, you know, it certainly wasn't the FOIA that, you know, spooked anyone. It was just the reporting, you know. So there were crazy phone calls that were, you know, coming in, but not as a result of any FOIA work.
Well, Jason, congratulations on your past success and best wishes for your continuing success in this terrific field that you've really mastered and developed. You're working for all of us, really.
Yeah.
You're working for the public benefit. Some people maybe feel threatened by the release of these documents or think you're a sinister figure, but I think probably 90%. The people who know of your work celebrate it and think you're a very, very valuable component of American democracy. And I certainly salute you for that.
Thank you, Jeff. So, thank you. I appreciate it. And I appreciate your support. And, you know, as you know, I've just been a huge fan of your work going back a long time.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm getting old. Long in the tooth, as they say. Anyway, thanks for coming on the show and spending this time with me. It's just been a great conversation.
Thank you, Jeff.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And that's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.